Welcome to Random Trek, a podcast where I, Scott McNulty, watch a random episode of Star Trek and talk about it with a non-random guest. Today's guest is Steve Lutz. Steve, thanks for joining me.
Actually, I am pretty random, so you may have failed already in your attempts.
Well, thanks so much, Steve, for being on. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
It's been fun.
So, Steve, how might people know you?
It's a very good question. I've been on the Incomparable podcast for quite a while now. And if they know me for any other reason, I have no idea why that would be. Because really the only thing that I've done that they would be aware of my existence for is being the occasional village idiot on that podcast. Well, so here I am, spreading out.
There you go. You can be an idiot on another podcast.
This is exciting.
That's why I invited you here.
Things are going to start happening for me now.
That's right. You're on the rise, Steve.
That's right. My star is shining ever more brightly by the moment.
It is true. So let's talk a little bit about your interest in Star Trek. Now, I am aware that perhaps you are not as interested in Star Trek as some. Is this true?
It is true. I mean, it's not that I dislike Star Trek or that I am, you know, aggressively disinterested in it. It's just that it always struck me growing up, which at the time all that was out there was the original series, as just kind of a goofy, fun thing that, you know, would come on every day on Channel 5 in the afternoon. And it would just be something that was on. And, you know, it never really struck me as something that I had to pay that much attention to. And by the time the Next Generation came out, I was in college and wasn't paying attention to much of anything. So I kind of missed my window there, I guess, by not being around in 67 and being basically unaware of anything outside of a very small circle of interests in the early 90s. But so
the Star Trek bug never bit you. But I know recently you watched, I was going to say rewatched, but watched for the first time probably most of... Well, you watched all of the original series, but most for the first time, I'm assuming.
This is true. Yeah, we did our fabled Wrath of Khan episode. Mm-hmm. Gosh, it must be like a year and a half, 2 years ago now. And I actually hadn't seen that before either, but was looking for an excuse to get on the podcast and thought, you know, that would be fun because, you know, I've seen enough of that that I know that there's a lot to talk about there. And then having done that... I was thinking, well, maybe, you know, I know there's got to be a original series episode coming soon, so maybe I'll start watching some of those because I enjoyed the Wrath of Khan quite a bit, and you know, I thought it'd be fun to kind of explore the origins of the characters and their relationships and so forth. And so, as I was thinking about starting with that, I happened to mention to my daughter that I was interested in checking out the original series, and she said, "Well, put it on, we'll check it out." And so we watched the first episode, and she was immediately hooked by the bright colors and the multicolored foam block food and Spock's ears and Kirk's removable shirt. And so we actually sat through, or rather we watched with great enjoyment, the entire series up until right around series 3 episode, whatever the Empath is.
Then things took a turn for the worse.
Yeah, it sapped our enthusiasm in a big way. And we never really got back to those last, whatever it is, 6 episodes or so that were left. It might have been the Let That Be Your Last Battlefield might have been the last one we watched. Not because that one was particularly bad, but because we had just, you know... That was all we had left after the Empath. We got maybe 2 more episodes, and then we were done.
I enjoy Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, but...
I thought that was pretty good, if a little overwrought, but then again...
Well, it is true.
What original series episode isn't a little overwrought?
It's true. It's not a subtle show in general. Which brings us to the random episode we're watching today, which, by luck, is an original series episode titled...
Oh, imagine that.
I know. Who knew? The Apple... From season 2, episode 9, first
the
aired
Apple.
October 13th, 1967.
In which Chekhov teaches Hutch how to give hickeys.
That is
the Apple, folks. The Apple is Chekhov getting it on with a yeoman that's way too hot for him.
It is true. It is very... The Chekhov plot is very strange. But, yeah, so the idea is that the Enterprise... has been assigned to check out this planet, So they beam down, and everybody's like, ooh, look, it's paradise. It's like Eden.
Yes.
Everything's wonderful. The temperature is always 76 degrees.
There's a handful of fake-looking ferns, and the temperatures are moderate. And apparently that's enough for them to start rattling on about paradise.
They all are really in love with it.
Except their standards are very low.
It's true. And Chekhov, so they beam down. It's Spock, McCoy, Kirk, obviously, Chekhov, and a yeoman, a female yeoman, and three or four security officers.
Yes.
And they look around. Everybody says it's paradise. Chekhov attempts to seduce the yeoman briefly.
I don't want to go too far afield here, but can you, as somebody who's a big Star Trek guy, mm-hmm. explain the purpose of Chekhov to me? I've never really gotten it. Was he like the proto Will Wheaton of his day, or what was the point of introducing Chekhov in season two?
He was introduced to probably fulfill very much the same function that Will Wheaton's character did, in that they wanted to appeal to a younger audience, and so they got this young actor, put a wig on him, a Beatles wig, and said, "Hey, get in there with your wacky Russian accent and just do some stuff."
Yeah.
And according to, I did a little research because I am a good podcast host, and according to the internet, The Apple is the first episode with Chekhov in it, where he is not wearing a wig. That is his hair that we are seeing.
Inexplicably, it actually looks worse, which is really sad. Well, see, now, if you're going to cast a guy to be sort of the audience stand-in everyman young dude, why pick a guy that absolutely no one in the audience could possibly relate to?
I don't know. I think it was he's Russian, right? So this was during the 60s, so the Cold War was still going on, and I think that they wanted to show that, yes, look, in the future, all of mankind gets along. We don't have to worry about this Cold War nonsense.
Even more importantly, in a very Jonathan Coulton sense, there will come a day, someday soon, when even a dork like Chekhov, or dare I say it, even me, will be accepted, even desired, by beautiful women, such as this yeoman whose name I never got.
According to this thing that I'm reading, her name is Yeoman Martha Landon.
Martha Lamb?
Martha Landon.
Oh, Landon.
Not Lamb. It's not that bad.
I thought they had extended this horribly ham-handed Garden of Eden metaphor even farther. So
no.
All right.
So Chekhov makes a joke about how the Garden of Eden was just outside of Moscow. And then things take a turn that no one was expecting when a plant turns, shoots darts at one of the security officers, whose name is, I guess, Hendriff, according to this page, and he's dead.
I think Bones waves his flashlight battery over him and announces it.
Yes, and he doesn't attempt to do anything at all to save him.
Well,
he's just
does.
Like, nope, he's dead.
Well, the battery knows all. If the battery says no, he's gone. There's no point in even trying.
And then we're into the credits. Credits are over, and Kirk calls
what did somebody say? That paradise must have looked like this?
I wrote that down as well, because he said it very, very dramatically. Kirk is having a bad day in this episode. He's not handling this well at all.
Not nearly as bad as Spock has, but we'll get to that.
That's true. Or the other people who actually die.
Oh, this is red shirt hell. I don't know what it is about the Garden of Eden, but
this may be the episode that started the red shirt phenomena, I think. Because they suffer great deaths in their ranks.
Yes.
So Kirk calls up to Scotty and says, what's up? Scotty is talking there. The antimatter pods are having some problems, and he can't explain why. But they're trying to figure it out. Spock has scanned the planet. I don't know why they didn't scan before.
Yeah, this strikes me as a thing they should maybe have checked before they beamed half the crew down to the surface.
You would think so, including the captain.
I'm fairly certain they have pretty good scanners on board the ship, sensors, because I think they can pick off like one guy walking around down to the planet's surface in a previous episode. But apparently these massive abnormalities in the electromagnetic field went completely unremarked on.
And these subterranean vibrations that are happening everywhere.
Yes. Well, yeah, you have to be right down there on the surface to pick up on those.
Clearly.
Yes.
The Kirk sends off his flunkies to look around, but to stay in communication. Spock detects a humanoid lurking like a cat. Yes. Which did not, this humanoid, when we see him later, is not lurking like a cat, so I don't,
no,
I'm not quite
not
sure
even remotely.
What it's, that came up, what that...
It seems utterly unlikely that he could ever possibly move like a cat.
No, he seems non-cat-like as you can get.
Right. And there's a great a window into the military lifestyle of Starfleet here when they discover that the cat-like being is moving around out there. Kirk says, "We're moving out. Formation L." And apparently Formation L is Starfleet code for a single file line, because they immediately form one and just kind of wander off into the distance.
Well, they go towards the village, right, in their single file Formation L.
In Formation L, right. But yeah, L is line, maybe.
Oh, or, see, there you go.
Follow the leader. I don't know what.
I guess he was speaking in code because he didn't want the interloper, although they're the interlopers, really, the person spying on them to hear.
But if he moves like a cat, he might also have hearing like a cat. So
that's true. Maybe,
that makes perfect sense.
It is, well, what also then makes sense, perfect sense, is that Spock picks up a rock. Checks it out. He doesn't scan it or anything. He just picks it up and he's like, this rock is very light and very dense. It could be useful. And then he breaks it in half and he's like, it's very brittle. And then he's done with it. So what do you do when you're done with a rock? You've broken it in half. You throw it on the ground.
Sure, of course.
And then it explodes.
I should note that as he's analyzing this rock, what he announces about it is fragile, good cleavage. After he breaks it, he says, good cleavage. So apparently that's something you do as a space geologist, is you use your hands to crack open the rock and you check the cleavage produced.
Well, that's just good science, Steve.
Right.
Good
Sure. And then what Kirk tells him is, he reminds him of those geologic principles when he asks him, would you mind being careful where you throw your rocks, Mr. Spock?
That's true.
That's Space Geology 101.
Yes. And so they notice that something is a weird on this planet, random flowers that shoot darts at people, and exploding rocks that only explode when you throw them.
Right. But not when you crack them in half with your hands.
Right, which you would think would make them explode, but it doesn't explode. So
I think it's contact with Vulcan flesh somehow neutralizes unstable substances, like exploding rocks.
Or poison, as we see.
Or poison, or lightning bolts, or any other types of things that might potentially harm anybody else.
Garden of Eden is paradise.
With landmines.
And the Enterprise is not doing well. Apparently, the inner-minded pods now are completely inert. They can't get away. But they don't know why. Spock thinks it might have to do with these vibrations.
Again, something we might have noticed slightly earlier, but okay.
Well, who knows? Then McCoy discovers the astounding fact that he thinks the darts the flowers shot and killed their red shirt are, in fact, poisonous.
Oh, no kidding.
And he reports that to Kirk, who probably agrees. And they are talking. But while they're talking, a flower turns and takes aim.
Quite obviously.
Very obviously. The only person who notices is Spock. And Spock very bravely yells, "Watch out, Captain!" And then throws Captain Kirk out of the way and takes a chest full of poisonous darts.
That's rough.
It is rough. It couldn't.
So this is the first example of this writer apparently has a thing against Spock and red shirts. Obviously, the red shirts take it badly, but Spock, I think, he gets hit three times as hard as your average red shirt because he survives.
It's true. He keeps coming back for more. So he is seemingly dead.
Right.
But everyone springs into action to try to save Spock. Nobody sprang into action to try to save poor Hendruff. They were just like, he's dead, let's keep looking.
Well, do you know how much Starfleet has invested in Spock?
Yes, 100.
It's a lot.
50,000. That's enough, Spock.
Yeah, but it's like $60 into that red shirt earlier.
That's true. His training's
expendable.
Not very good. And so Kirk calls up to Scotty and does what he probably should have done when the plant life killed one of his crew members and they notice that rocks explode, and say, hey, maybe we should leave this planet and check it out from afar.
Yes.
But sadly, the Enterprise is drained of power and cannot transport them up. So they're stuck on the surface of the planet, and we think Spock is dead, but he's not dead.
Transportus interruptus. And here we get some really sweet, serious, dramatic zooms. This whole episode is chock full of them, but we get Scotty saying, the way it is now, we couldn't beam up a fly. And then there's this awesome, like the camera goes way in, like almost up his nose. And then we cut to Kirk on the surface, and he doesn't even say anything, but we also get a super dramatic zoom on him. And then we cut to commercial. It's disorienting and wonderful.
Yes, and there's another zoom that's very odd later on in the episode, which we'll get to.
Yes.
And I think you probably know what I'm talking about.
I do.
So now we think it cuts the commercial, so we think Spock is dead. That's it. Mm-hmm. But he's not actually dead.
Right.
He regains consciousness because McCoy has injected him with a bunch of stuff that he, once again, did not bother to inject into the red shirt, let it be known. Spock regains consciousness, and everyone's like, oh, how are you, Spock? And Spock says, I feel just like I do whenever Dr. McCoy injects me full of things. My stomach is upset.
Yes. It's really amazing how the thorns pierced Spock's chest but left his shirt completely intact.
Well, he has backup shirt.
That's what, if only Kirk did.
Well, he has more to show off.
I would say that Starfleet fabric is somehow self-healing, but I've seen Kirk's shirt tear at least 60 times, and it never seems to piece itself back together. So I don't know. Maybe it's some of that stuff that Bones shot into him is actually causes the fibers in the shirt to mend.
That's very strange.
True.
And Kirk is wearing his command blouse, his alternate command blouse in this episode.
The moob hiding and gut supporting command blouse.
Very strange. So Kirk basically yells at Spock for saving his life and then asks him if he, as Steve alluded to earlier, if he realizes how much Starfleet has spent on Spock and how it's a waste. It would have been a waste of all of that money is implied if Spock had died on this planet.
And here Bones takes yet another opportunity to bag on Spock for having green blood.
Bones is a racist.
He really is. I mean, well, so is Kirk. He takes pot shots at him all the time, too.
It's true.
I mean, for all the advancements that we have made, we still have green blood cracks being made on quite possibly the most competent member of all Starfleet.
And then Mallory, who's another security officer, has found the village that they're looking for and communicates back to Kirk that he's found it, but his communicator stops working. So Kirk is very upset and rushes to find him. And the party finds Mallory. And Mallory's very excited, and he's telling them about the village. And as he's walking towards them, what does he do? He steps on an exploding rock and dies.
Yes.
Which is sad for everybody.
Did we miss the lightning storm? I think there's a lightning storm somewhere in between there.
Yes, there might be a lightning storm. Yes, there is, right before they reconnect with Mallory. It gets very cloudy, and there's suddenly a lightning storm, and then Kirk
the sky is blue instead of red, and as we enjoy the stock footage of clouds sped up, and then lightning zaps two guys, leaving behind. Is it one guy? Because I'm pretty sure they leave like one smoking puddle of goo, and they run to another smoking puddle of goo.
One guy gets vaporized by the lightning. Right. So, yes, the total three red shirts get killed in this episode. One by the darts, one
by
the
lightning. That's still a pretty good ratio.
And one by an exploding rock.
Is this maybe just a ploy to get us to worry about the future of the yeoman who we'll never actually see again, but we're told is important because she actually is willing to hang out with Chekhov?
I think it might be. And plus, it puts the characters in peril. Spock certainly is in peril in this episode.
Right. But not really. I mean, we know Spock.
We know he's going to make it, but he has a hard time of it.
He does. Well, it's the blue shirt, man. It's self-healing, and it's lightning-proof, and all sorts of things. That's why you hope to get into the command ranks, because those red shirts, they don't stop anything.
Well, technically, blue is science, Steve.
Oh, I know. Red is what, engineering and security or something?
Yep. And gold is...
Why do I know these things, Scott? I blame you.
Probably my fault. And so Mallory's dead. People are... Kirk basically has a breakdown. He's very upset. He says, I could have prevented all of this. Spock finds that illogical and wonders how the captain could have prevented this. And Kirk's response
is... The truth is, Kirk is absolutely right here.
It's true. I mean, well...
completely preventable by some very basic scans as you're orbiting the planet, and also maybe like looking around for darts that might be shot out of flowers before running around the planet.
They don't actually actively scan for things while they're on the planet either, after the security guy has been shot by poisonous darts.
This is true.
You would think they would just actively scan. If they're going to stay on the planet, because they have to, just keep scanning for stuff right. And make sure you avoid things that perhaps will explode.
Or at least keep your head on a swivel for rotating flowers.
That's true. Keep your eyes peeled, folks.
I don't even see a whole lot of that. I don't see a whole lot of concern about stepping on landmines. I don't... It's just a... You know, maybe the real fault with Kirk here is he sent down the dumbest group of engineering / security guys on the ship.
That's yes, but his Kirk's solution isn't that they should have scanned it, but rather he should have just not followed orders and not even bothered doing any of this and left the planet.
Maybe just heading back to the ship upon the first red shirt death and regrouping would have been a wise move.
That's probably what I would have done. But
instead, they chat on the comms for a while, and then I think Scotty, like as the guy's body is still cooling, is sort of he's angling around for an opportunity to walk around on the planet, which I think is pretty poor etiquette. But
that is true. I forgot that
what
part.
Can you do?
Scotty takes the opportunity after he's been told that one of his crewmates has been horribly killed to point out, "I could go for a walk on a planet."
Right.
Hint, hint.
Meanwhile, directly under Kirk's communicator, the man is bleeding out.
There is a corpse. Scotty doesn't care.
Yeah.
He only cares about
engineers, man. They have absolutely no sense of etiquette.
Speaking of Scotty, he finds out that the ship is being held in place and they cannot leave. But then...
A tractor beam!
Then the mysterious stalker returns and Kirk has a plan. He says, "Okay, Spock, Chekhov... You two pretend like you're having a fight, or just be loud to distract our stalker, and I'll circle around behind him," which he does.
Yes.
And he comes up behind their stalker, who is
Oompa Loompa.
An Oompa Loompa who's very muscular.
That's right.
And Kirk doesn't say anything, and he just punches the guy in the face.
As you do.
This is first contact, I should point out.
Yeah, exactly.
And the guy starts to cry, which I don't think Kirk was expecting.
It's not the usual response he gets from immediately punching people he meets in the face.
And the man is like, why did you hit me, basically? And Kirk is like...
You struck me with your hand.
Yes. And Kirk is like, well, you're looking at us. Funny. So why shouldn't I punch in the face? To which he finds out this person introduces himself as the eyes of Val.
The voice of Val.
The voice of Val.
And also the eyes of Val.
He's many functions of Val.
Yes. We learn that one of Val's greatest gifts to his people is streak-proof white mascara.
That's right. They are very tanned, or kind of orangey tan, really. White hair, yes. Right?
Yeah.
A lot of weird makeup.
Not a whole lot of clothing.
Not a lot of clothing.
Flowers in their hair, hippie all hippie-like.
They're very hippie. They're hippie Oompa Loompas, I think.
The big white pompadour in the classic Oompa Loompa style.
Yes. And this guy's name is Akatu, I guess?
Akuta.
He has some antennae that are coming out of his neck.
He was apparently involved in a tragic mishap with one of those novelty wire puzzles where you try to get the two pieces apart.
Those are tough.
They are. And I guess he was working a little hard on them once and got them stuck in his neck. Because
slipped. And that's not good. And then this is where the point where the another zoom happens, I believe, because Spock notices the antenna and asks if he can check them out. And Akatu says, sure. And they zoom in super close to the antenna, which, I mean, I don't know. I'm watching it in digitally remastered, restored, super clear. So I could see them just fine from the shot.
Right. This is true.
So I'm not sure when it was originally aired. Perhaps it was harder to see. But it just seemed very weird.
Well, it was less usual in those days to see somebody with bits of wire stuck through pieces of skin all over his body.
I guess that's true. It might have been a little more shocking than it is
now. I think
that
was it. I think that's a shock Zoom right there.
Because, yeah.
Wire!
I could probably get that done
I'm on still South not Street sleeping from that Frankenstein movie. And now you got to show me this guy with wires sticking out of his neck.
And why is he
this
orange?
This is terrible.
Turn off the TV. Let's turn on Lawrence Welk.
Wonderful, wonderful. So, yeah, Akuta with wire in his neck.
Akuta with wire. Yes, but he's very gentle. He's very welcoming. He really did not deserve to be punched in the face. He was just observing them. He was scared, I think. But then he brings them to Val, who turns out to be a large serpent cave.
Right.
Weird eyes.
Yeah, at this point, I see Val, and I'm thinking, it's the face in the stone. Stay away from the teeth, Kirk. Stay away from the teeth.
Don't go
in. Do they stay
in
away from the teeth? No, they do not.
They do not.
Spock walks right into a force field as he is saying, or as he's about to say, that there's a force field there.
It is, in fact, kind of funny.
He strides headlong into it. Kirk says, a force field? And Spock says, obviously. So this is the second blow against Spock.
It's true. So if you're keeping tally, first poison darts, he walks into a force field.
Yes. He's very impressed, Spock, with the... I think that's the thing. He's distracted by the very high order of workmanship on display in the face of Val. And it is some
impressive.
Pretty solid papier-mâché work they've got going on there with Val.
And the detail and the painting of the eyes is very impressive.
Yes, yes. Well, it glows. I mean, that's hard to do.
It is true. So they're on Paradise, and they have encountered a serpent's head.
Yes.
So just in case people have not put those two things together yet, I just want to point them out. I don't know if it's symbolism of any kind.
I didn't even make that particular connection, but I was distracted by the analogy they were trying to make so clearly, and the subtle one completely slipped by unnoticed.
Well, good thing I'm here.
Yes, yes, thank goodness. I feel much edified about this episode.
So Kirk says, well, how do you talk to this thing? And he said, Akatu says, he talks to us when he's hungry. And then they feed him, I suppose.
Yes.
So
At this point, Kirk calls him Val. Immediately after, Akuta says Val. So this is yet another episode where they cannot get their pronunciation straight.
Which confuses me, because as we were leading up to this, I kept trying to think, is it Val or is it Val?
Right.
I think it is Val, though.
And then I think throughout the episode, it changes periodically. So I don't understand why they in the 60s did they not sit down for a read through at some point and discuss, you know, okay guys, the stucco lizard head is pronounced Val, not Val.
Shatner.
Or does the director simply not care?
I think that they probably rehearsed it a lot, and there's some things that my wife's name is Marisa, but some people can hear that and they hear Marissa.
Uh-huh.
And no matter how many times you correct them, they cannot tell the difference. So I think Val and Val have the same problem.
And when it's Shatner, I suspect the giving up happens a lot sooner.
I think so. He has so many other things to do. They're like, fine. No one's going to notice.
Sure. No one cares.
No
one this is a dumb episode anyway.
Exactly. We're just
let's just get through this thing. We've got a good script next week.
They do, actually. The one after this was really good. This one, not so much.
Alas, random number generator.
Damn it. So they go to the village to get some food and drink. Kirk says, well, where are the kids? And nobody knows what the word kids means, or children, I suppose. So he explains that there are little ones like you that grow. So Akashu says, oh, Val forbids them. And he also forbids sex.
Yes, well, the holding, the touching.
Exactly. I just cut to the chase.
That's right.
Which outrages McCoy.
There goes Paradise.
There goes Paradise. It's true.
The classic Bones line.
He scans them, though, and they are in perfect health. He has no idea how old they are, but they are in perfect health. So then they have to go off and feed Val.
Right.
So Spock and Kirk hide behind a bush as the villagers are feeding Val. And
oh, wait. We can't skip this because it's the best line in the episode. And that is, well, first of all, the people welcome them with this weird little gesture they've come up with, apparently entirely in case somebody is marooned on their planet. I'm not sure why they have a welcoming ritual when there's one village and it's like 10 people big and they clearly all know each other.
They might have been impromptu.
It's possible, yeah. It looks like it was impromptu.
I was going to say, because...
The guest house also seems somewhat extraneous, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, part of this ritual involves them wrapping these leis of big flowers around the crew's wrists. And Kirk says, "This really does something for you." And Spock's response, this is a great line, "Yes, indeed it does, Captain. It makes me uncomfortable." And he looks like he's got, you know, just a shovel full of sand down his breeches at that moment. It's wonderful. It's a good Spock line.
It is
pleases
true.
Me greatly.
And I was talking about T'Pol with Greg Noss on a previous episode where we watched an Enterprise episode, which led us to talk about Vulcans in general. And I think, thanks to Leonard Nimoy, one of Vulcans' kind of characteristics that we know and love is their barely contained contempt of other species.
That's right. And well, they're horrible races too. So what they get from Kirk and Bones, really, he
exactly.
gives right
what,
back.
What goes around comes around. So,
but in a much more subtle and cutting way.
Yes, and so that's a perfect example of, and I'm glad you brought that up because I had that slipped my mind. But that is a great scene with the weird wrist lays they give people.
Yes, yes, which they had prepared for just such a moment,
just in case.
Fireworks on Endor, we always keep these around for
you never
no
know
particular reason
when visitors or celebrations might happen.
Not that we've ever had either, but someday maybe Vol will maybe, it
exactly. Vol might have a good day. So they have to feed Vol.
Possible.
We find out they feed him these rocks that explode.
They do?
That's what I thought. I was looking, and I think they're putting those rocks into Vol.
Oh, okay. See, that makes a lot more sense. I thought they had gathered fruits and vegetables
that's
in
what
the
I
baskets.
Thought the first time I watched it,
and
it didn't
I
make
was
any
thinking,
sense.
Oh, it doesn't, but then again, I mean, it's Vol. So I mean, he may have a Mr. Fusion inside.
He might. I'm pretty sure that they're putting those rocks in there.
That could be. But they don't explode.
They don't
which
explode.
Is,
they're
which
handling
is also strange.
Them very carefully.
And they I assumed it was fruits and veggies, and I was, you know, I was shivering because they were dumping the baskets right, and I was thinking, oh, Rubio's is not going to like that. It says right on their trash cans, don't throw those baskets away. But if it's the big rocks that makes that, well, it doesn't make actually any more sense because it doesn't explode. So
I don't know. That's what I thought, but I could be wrong. We'll go to the videotape and confirm this later.
All right. Yes. let's call out the instant replay folk.
But as they are feeding either rocks or fruits and vegetables to Vol, which on Star Trek, really, as we see on the Enterprise food, very similar anyway. So
yes, true.
Kirk and Spock are crouched behind a bush watching this happen. And Kirk says, well, now's our chance because the force field is down, so we can go sneak up. So he stands up, and then they have another one of these weird cuts where they flash to the eyes. And then they immediately cut back to Kirk and Spock, and Kirk sits back down and says, well, that's not going to work.
Yeah. Well, the eyes glow slightly, so that's a sign that you know, maybe we should
out.
Back off. Yeah. Meanwhile, all this time, Scotty is on board the ship, doing everything within engineering reason to keep the tractor beam from pulling them into the planet.
That is true, and to a knowledge which Kirk uses to tell them to calculate how much energy it is taking Vol to keep them in the tractor beam so right. that they can use their Enterprise's maximum energy to kind of try to get out to make Vol get hungry so that they can sneak in and talk to Vol, I guess. I don't know what his plan was. But
there's a nice running bit here where basically it turns out that Scotty has basically 8 hours or whatever it is to live, assuming that the Hail Mary they're throwing up that they always throw up every episode doesn't work, there's this little exchange where if you don't fix it you're fired, says Kirk, and I like that bit. They go back to it a couple of times, and actually when it doesn't work he comes back later and says, all right, you're fired, but then he rehires them when they actually manage to, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but they actually manage to defeat Vol at the end.
What?
And then Scotty is rehired.
Spoiler
but we get a lot
alert.
Of a lot of good scenes here of Scotty looking constipated while engineers run around behind him. And at one point, immediately after he says they're doing everything with an engineering reason, one of his underlings comes in with, I swear it's a plate of those multicolored foam blocks that they eat on board the ship.
It could
and
be.
And he dumps it underneath the bridge computer console. And
you have to feed.
I think it's a parallel to
you
Vol.
You have to feed the computer.
That's what it is. It's a parallel to the whole Vol thing. I think there's even more subtlety going on here.
And then, and then we cut back to McCoy is complaining that Vol is robbed these people of their free will and he's right. not happy about it. And that leads to a very nice exchange, I think, where Spock points out that, you know, there are, you're applying human values to a non-human society, and maybe there are many solutions to the same problem, and they're maybe they're happy doing what they're doing.
They seem happy.
McCoy rejects it.
Yeah.
Out
as
of
he
hand.
Does.
And Kirk also agrees that it's no good.
But of course, Spock, cold logic filled as he is not at all bothered by it. He sees a system that functions properly, and people are happy and healthy, but, you know, they aren't free to grow. They aren't
That's
free
right.
to make progress.
They can't.
They're basically slaves to the machine.
Aren't we all, Steve, when we come right down to it?
Oh, man. But, gentlemen, I think this philosophical argument can wait until our ship's out of danger.
Probably.
So it gets broken
But
up
it can't
before.
Wait until there's an awkward scene where Kirk asks the villagers, well, if one of you dies, where does the other one come? Where does another replacement come? And they explain Vol provides the hall. And then they go back to the yeoman, and Chekhov and Spock and McCoy are sitting around a table or a rock or something. And she says, I don't understand where the new ones come from. And they have a very strange and awkward conversation about...
This is a very painful, painful scene.
Where they don't want to talk about sex, but they have to talk about sex.
The yeoman seems like she's embarrassed to talk about sex in front of Spock. And she says, I mean, how is it done? And then, like, they zoom in on her, and she just has this totally blank, dumb bunny look on her face. And it's like, it's at the expense of the dumb yeoman. And I don't know. You explain it to the young lady, says Kirk. And it's just, the whole thing is just, I don't know. I feel greasy afterwards.
Yeah, it's a sign that we're watching a show that was shot in the mid-60s, I think.
It is.
And then McCoy, Spock says, well, I suppose Vol will provide. And McCoy says, I'd like to see a machine teach them how to do that. Oh, McCoy, always ending awkward scenes with an even more awkward statement.
Yes, and that's what he's good for.
But then, after, I guess, all this talk of awkward talk of sex has gotten the yeoman ready to make out with Chekhov, because they go off into the forest and start kissing.
Oh, my God, I never made that connection.
Well,
the
that
fact
is...
that maybe the reason that they have to sneak off for some alone time is because they're a little hot and bothered from all the hot talk.
I'm assuming. Why else would they do it? I don't know.
Oh, my God. Yeah, this scene is bothersome, too. Not the least because it's Chekhov and the hot yeoman, which just is the cognitive dissonance is way too much for me.
But, it is not good. And then so villagers see that, and then they say, hey, that looks like fun. We should do it.
Yeah.
And they do. And this angers Vol greatly. So the ground starts shaking.
Yeah.
Akatu finds them, scolds them, and communicates to Vol. And he realizes that Kirk and Spock are dangerous, and they must be killed.
Oh, it should be mentioned here too that the watcher in the bushes of the people of Vol is Hutch, David Soul from the Starsky and Hutch show.
Oh, I did not make that connection.
It's him. He's a bit younger than he was in his Hutch days, but that is indeed him under that pompadour and makeup. And last person that should be learning how to give a hickey from Pav Chekhov.
Well, now that you say that, though, it is, I made the connection. Crazy, man. 60s TV, it's crazy.
It is. It's so incestuous.
It's true. And so Vol commands all the male folks to gather, and where Akotu says we have to kill Spock and Kirk.
He prepares a short clinic on head smashing.
It's true. The children of Vol do not know what killing is, so he gets a melon and some kind of weird branch-like thing, I guess.
Yeah, he tells the rest of them to find a heavy stick, but he has some sort of tuning fork made of metal. I'm not sure why he doesn't just hand more of those out.
I don't know. Maybe he only had one. Vol only has the one. And then he smashes the melon and says, do that to their heads.
Yes.
And,
at which point I do have to smile a bit thinking of Chekhov's head exploding.
and then Kirk decides, okay, we've got to destroy Vol and set these people free, which Spock disagrees with because it's against the Prime Directive, which they don't call the Prime Directive in this episode.
It's the non-interference clause or something, right?
Yes, but it is the Prime Directive. Kirk... As always,
this might
care.
Be like the one and only time they ever actually discuss it before they go ahead and violate it, which is...
Usually Kirk is a man of action. He doesn't want to talk about things. He just wants to do it. And Spock's reasoning does not sway Kirk at all, because he says, That's an interesting theory you have there, Spock, but we're going to do it anyway. So they go up to the Enterprise and say, hey, Scotty, are you done doing what we need you to do so we can get to Vol? And Scotty says, well, we still need about half an hour. They only have 47 minutes to live. So Kirk is like, well, you better get it done because you're going to die, obviously. Spock tells Kirk that the people of Vol have disappeared, and they go to Vol to see what's going on. The force field is down.
Yeah.
Kirk talks to Vol, or at least tries to. This does not please Vol. But instead of hitting Kirk with a lightning bolt...
You guessed it.
He hits Spock with a lightning bolt.
Dude cannot catch a break in this episode.
He cannot. So Kirk carries...
And here we learn that Starfleet's thornproof fabric is not actually impervious to lightning. Although,
no, lightning
the
tough.
Standard issue protective black undershirt is another matter entirely.
Well, that's just sensible wear.
Yeah, you know, you gotta have a second level of protection.
It's true.
It's like shields and armor, you know.
I thought you were going to say shields and Yarnell for some reason.
I believe actually the Starfleet fabric is Yarnell.
There you go. So, Spock is stunned. He gets dragged back to the village. McCoy looks him over and says, hey, he has second-degree burns. Those probably hurt. And Spock confirms that, yes, they do, in fact, hurt. And then the villagers return, and they kill one of these security guys.
Yes, the last of the non-hot yeoman red shirts goes down in the epic Oompa Loompa rumble.
But they... Since the Oompa Loompas...
I think we're actually up to four at this point.
Yes, this is the fourth red shirt that dies.
Wow.
And they are not... The Children of Vol are not really an effective fighting force.
No, they go down pretty quick.
They do. They are imprisoned in one of their huts. And
they have not been trained in the arts of shirtless kung fu as Kirk has.
It is
Although,
true.
Amazingly, Kirk does not lose his shirt in this episode.
No,
everybody else in the episode is not wearing a shirt, but he keeps his.
His shirt is intact.
Maybe we have actually gone to the mirror world without knowing it.
That's true. You never know.
In the real world, the Oompa Loompas have beards.
And shirts.
That's right.
So Scotty is diverting all power to the impulse engines. They only have 12 minutes to live. Kirk once again spirals into self-doubt. He is very concerned that everyone's going to die, which is a valid concern as a captain of a ship, I think.
Now, about this redirecting power to the impulse engines, is there some reason why everything that Scotty has to do on board ship involves physically rewiring a console somewhere? Shouldn't some of this stuff be like built into the programming?
Well, it's less dramatic if Scotty just says, computer, reroute power to the impulse engines.
Had they worked through that in Next Generation? Me not being a Next Generation guy, I don't know, but it seems like in that time, maybe, you know, the automatic rerouting of power would be something they would have added.
Still a lot of button pressing, and sometimes some actual manual labor is required.
Oh, man.
It just builds up the tension, Steve.
Yeah.
So they reroute the power, draining Val's power, and they... Kirk says, hey... Shoot Vol with the phasers. And they do. And
amazingly, the phasers are one of the few systems aboard the ship that were not completely drained by their failed attempt to pull away from the tractor beam.
Lucky for them, but not so
it's
lucky
amazing.
For Vol, because Vol is now dead. And then the Enterprise starts working.
Yes. Scotty is rehired at this point.
He is. They release the villagers, and the villagers are very confused and worried about what they're going to do. Kirk says, don't worry, it'll be hard work, but you'll enjoy it, which I really don't think I would, and they leave.
I think it seems pretty clear that they aren't going to enjoy it that much either, although we do end on the classic sitcom laughter.
Yes.
As they're sort of becoming aware that they're going to be getting it on Chekhov style any day now.
It is true. And then they, Kirk, McCoy, and Spock have a little chat aboard the Enterprise wherein... Spock says, maybe we did the wrong thing by introducing this. Maybe we were the serpent or the devil in the Garden of Eden story because we deprived these people of Vol. To which Kirk says, there's only one of us who looks like the devil.
Another hilarious Vulcan racist jab.
It's true. And then the episode is over because Spock is a jerk.
Right. Although, to be honest, Spock did sort of earn it by earlier going off about humans killing each other again. But anyway, yeah, I thought actually, you know, I didn't hate this episode. It's very Star Trek, the original series.
Yes, it is quite of its time, shall we say.
I mean, it's there's some action. There's some goofy-looking guys. I mean, there's a whole lot of silly nonsense in service of a really weak, ham-handed analogy. I think probably the thing that I dislike most about it is that it's just not all that memorable. I mean, I didn't remember having seen this when I watched all of those episodes less than a year ago, maybe a little over a year ago at this point. But this one, even when I went and looked it up on Memory Alpha and read the plot, I was like, God, did I watch that? And it took me fully 30 minutes into this episode before I realized, oh, okay, yeah, this is the one with the Garden of Eden analogy. So, I mean, although it's got a lot of the sort of key elements of a good Star Trek episode, it never really turns into much that sticks with you.
It doesn't gel. I think it's lacking. I think the point you're making is valid. It doesn't. The best of the Star Trek, the original series episodes are either just kind of goofy fun, or they really drive home kind of a poignant point. In this episode, there's some fun, and there's an attempt to have kind of a lesson, but the lesson is Kirk knows what's best, not Vol.
I don't. The lesson is dumb.
The lesson is dumb. It's true.
And it's kind of weird when I think about it, because there's a lot of positives. There's the whole Spock getting zapped repeatedly that should stick out in my mind, but doesn't. There's the fact that I think there's a greater percentage of red shirt death in this than has come before, and quite possibly even came later, and yet I don't recall that.
It is true, and as when I generated it, when this episode got picked, I had no memory after reading this the summary of having ever watched it either. But as I watched it, I realized I had seen it probably more than once, but it just does not stick with you.
Yeah, I think what it comes down to is the shock of seeing Pav, Chekhov, and the Hot Yeoman together is just too much.
You just block it out.
That's exactly right. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, you can say that at some point in the future, guys like Pav Chekhov will have a chance with Yeoman What's-Her-Face. But, I mean, what year is the original series? Is like the 23rd century?
Yes.
That's not long enough for Pav Chekhov. I'm sorry. It just doesn't work. I can accept the shirtless guy with the antenna sticking out of his neck. I can accept the papier-mâché head that somehow keeps an entire planet at an even 76 degrees and somehow controls the atmosphere to the point that he even prevents aging. But Pav Chekhov and Hot Yeoman, no. It's just too much.
It's a
you ask too much
too
of
far.
Me, Max, whatever your name is, writer of The Apple.
With that, Steve, thank you for joining me on Random
Trek. It's been
Trek.
My pleasure. It's been fun to remember this episode, and I've already forgotten it again.
Forgotten what? Next on Random Trek, our first Deep Space Nine episode, looking for Parmok in all the wrong places.